like disease. Temperatures rising soon, we're gonna have a fever.
And hot it is, I understand, along the East Coast, hot and humid, lots of people heading for the ice bar in Manhattan. That's a sign of the times, huh? There's something called an ice bar where they serve ice-cold drinks, and it looks like the inside of an igloo, according to a story I saw on the Today Show. Hello, and happy Wednesday. I'm Betsy Rosenberg. Pleased to be with you today. D.R. Tucker is tied up with his other job, so he will not be joining us. But someone who introduced me to our next guest, D.R. is someone who introduced me to our next guest, who is John Reeves. And I met John recently at the Citizens Climate Lobby Conference in Washington, D.C. Was back there a couple weeks ago. You may recall that we had Judy Weiss, Rabbi Judy Weiss of CCL, on the program a couple of weeks ago. So John is available today. He's checking in from San Diego in Southern California, where it's probably pretty pleasant in the 70s, I would imagine. He has been practicing law for some 30 years in environmental, business, and insurance disputes and litigation. He's also a climate activist, my favorite kind of person these days, and is the founding director of Citizens Climate Lobby, my favorite organization, as regular listeners know. That began in 2007, that group, and John is also policy director for the U.S. Green Chamber of Commerce, has been for the last couple of years. He looks to get parties to work together on many fronts. That is a skill most needed in today's era of a lot of conflict, a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of miscommunication. And John also works as an environmental mediator. He co-founded the Land Use and Environmental Mediation Group. That is a division of the National Conflict Resolution Center with four other specialists. And John frequently writes and speaks about climate and other green issues. So great to have you on the show, John. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Great to be here.
Yeah, kind of a long bio, longer than I usually give, but it's all impressive, and I really appreciate the fact that with 30 years legal experience and expertise, you are really devoting a lot of your time and attention and energy to the climate crisis. How did you turn to focus on this, and when did that happen?
It happened about 7 years ago. I had long known that climate change was happening, was going to happen, that our generation would start seeing some of the worst effects. And it suddenly occurred to me I'd been devoting a lot of time to private party disputes, litigation. And I got mad about 7 years ago and said, I've got to look much more outwardly. And so I've been an activist since that time.
Well, perfect that you would be lobbying members of both sides of the political aisle, especially some doubtful Republican representatives, perhaps. So we were at the Citizens Climate Lobby a couple of weeks ago, but before we hear about how that went for you, tell us how you came to be, one of the co-founders of CCL?
Well, yes, I wrote an op-ed, my first one on climate change in 2007. And a gentleman who I did not know, Marshall Saunders, who founded and created Citizens Climate Lobby, gave me a call, came into my office, and basically said, hey, I'm about to get this organization started, would love to see you get involved. And I've been involved from the very get-go. It's been a really remarkable trip. Citizens Climate Lobby, you probably know, but listeners may not, was modeled on the results model. They've been around for close to 30 years, and their MO is to have a grassroots, volunteer, nonpartisan group in every congressional district throughout the country so that each group has a constituent to ping the respective members of Congress with a very laser-focused message. And in our case, it's climate. In the results case, it was microloans for poverty.
And that worked so well that Marshall decided to apply that to the climate crisis. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. He had been a GORP presenter and came to the conclusion at some point that you can only turn in so many light bulbs and replace them with more efficient ones, but we need federal legislation to have any chance to tackle our climate problems. So he decided to make a bold move and create a new group, Citizens Climate Lobby, and I'm proud to say we are over 100 groups at this stage, with seven in Canada. We are expanding super, super fast. Dr. James Hansen has been saying for the last couple of years that if you want to get involved with climate activism, there's no better group to get involved with than CCL.
And in fact, Jim Hansen was one of the keynote presenters at the Citizens Climate Lobby just a few weeks back. That was exciting for all of us who, you know, revere him, but also because he has so much regard for the Citizens Climate Lobby.
Yes, very exciting. He is obviously a science advisor to our group as well.
So how did your lobbying go, since you are a veteran of the CCL?
Most interesting. This is my fourth year doing it. It was our fourth annual conference followed by lobbying. And the first year we had 25 people, second year about 75 people, third year about 150 people, this year about 370. And each time we go back, the message we convey, which is a similar focus message, is either already understood, better received, or greater receptivity to it with each year. And so this was a particularly exciting year. I can't come away from this saying that, oh, we just had a major change and we now expect climate legislation exactly as we wish. But I do feel that some things are shifting in the ground underneath. And that's the exciting part. We start seeing that some Republicans say, you know, we would get on board if others were to get on board, but we don't want to stick our necks out and things like that. So we feel that we're matchmakers, environmental matchmakers. We don't present any sort of partisanship in our meetings. We try to find out who people work with on the other side of the aisle, and we try behind the scenes to match these people up to see if we can get some excitement and some willingness, especially on the Republican side, to try to come out with something.
You mentioned matchmaking, and that reminds me that I also had Ellie Sparks on the show a couple of weeks ago, right after the lobby conference. And, you know, she always signs her emails. You know, those of us who are in on her email group, you know, love Ellie. And it's all about love, really, without getting too California woo-woo here, John. Really, isn't it about how do we love our kids, our country, our communities, our grandchildren, future generations? Isn't that really the real underlying question?
That is a great point, and that really expresses where the people in Citizens Climate Lobby come from. There is a true love of people and of country, a great passion being devoted. All these people are volunteers who go to Washington, a tremendous expense and time, and that shows the degree of dedication. It's a beautiful, I call it a brotherhood, but it's really a brotherhood and a sisterhood, and it's really a remarkable camaraderie that you find with like-minded people who are so passionate.
Now, the Citizens Climate Lobby, its mission is to create the political will for a livable planet, and the method to do that is to get a carbon tax passed. And even though carbon taxes are a couple of words that until recently no one would dare utter, part of the message I got from Mark Reynolds, the leader of CCL this time, was that it's okay to call it that because even conservatives are starting to talk about a carbon tax.
Mm-hmm. Well, I find it still a little bit of a negative word. I still prefer to call it a carbon fee. And the reason for the distinction is a tax to me is a tax that's levied by the government and brought into general coffers for general purposes. A fee, in this case, is a fee that's charged on a carbon polluting product, but because it's returned entirely to all households, it's revenue neutral, it's no longer a tax. And I think when people historically have talked about carbon tax, they don't have a revenue neutral aspect in mind. And today my observation is there's a mounting effort by some conservative camps to try to derail discussions about a carbon tax. So they frame it as a carbon tax as opposed to a revenue neutral carbon fee, which is a very different beast.
And do you find that semantics are important when you have these meetings on the Hill?
They are, because when I talk to some folks who say, well, I can't go along with any tax increase, I'm quick to point out this is not a tax increase. It's a tax swap. And that is a very different beast. Grover Norquist, who had so many Republicans sign on to a no tax increase pledge, as you know, over the last several years, earlier this year said if it's revenue neutral, he would not consider it a tax increase. So that's significant.
And do you think Congress, you know, in the foreseeable future will actually consider a carbon fee and dividend? I mean, it's one thing to get a better reception, and I'm so glad that the lobbyists are getting that because look what we're up against, fossil fuel industry and deep, deep, deep pockets and the Koch brothers. Or is this really something that we could dare hope for?
I think we can dare hope for it. Is it close feeling? I won't say yes, but the fact that there is discussion on many fronts right now tells me that this actually has a chance to like a pinball bounce around from here to there. You can't even track it, and all of a sudden it's going down the right slot.
And we kind of need a critical mass of buzz about it, and then things can take off from there, even though it's not exactly like you're convincing, you know, 100% of the Congress to vote for it. You get enough, and then they start talking to their colleagues. Is that how it works?
Exactly. I would dare say that our representatives are more like lemmings than leaders. And so when they feel that the party apparatus is moving a certain way, they jump on board. But it's a rare congressman to want to stick a head out on a controversial issue and truly lead. So that's the whole reason for Citizens Climate Lobby having these various nonpartisan grassroots groups in order to drum up a political wind so that at some point, congressmen in all these different districts hopefully will say, huh, I see that my constituency is supporting it, and I feel I can stick my neck out. If somebody actually starts leading this, I'll jump on board.
Mm.
Right now is a very interesting time, Betsy. When we were there last year, Democrats typically would say, we got beaten up with the cap and trade. We thought the Republicans were on board, and we're not doing anything. It's up to the Republicans. And the Republicans, of course, would say, you know, our party's not in the mood if they even wanted to say that. This year, very, very different. Starting with last fall, the Brookings Institute, the Heritage Foundation, and then this year, various organizations, including this past month, the R Street Group, have been talking about the benefits, the pros and cons of a carbon tax, whether it's revenue neutral or otherwise. Even the Congressional Budget Office has come out with an analysis. So there's a lot of buzz about it. And so my sense is that it could end up being part of a grand tax rearrangement, some sort of grand tax bargain. So I do feel a much greater receptivity from Republicans, and there is a lot of motivation in the Republican camp to make a cleaner, more streamlined tax code. So we might actually see things fall into place. I'd love to say this year, maybe next year.
Despite the lobbying efforts of the fossil fuel interests, and yet you have taken a closer look at what some of the big oil companies have said in their public statements about climate change and climate policy. What did you find that might have been surprising?
Well, I found the compilation of seven major oil companies to be remarkable when I pulled them all together. Now, I understand that people who work in oil companies don't find it remarkable at all that it's old news, but I don't think this old news has slipped out very much beyond the folks who work in the oil industry. And what I found startling was, I'll first set the context. We being lay people, environmentalists, generally think that the oil companies will disavow, if not create, climate change by funding denial groups such as the Koch brothers, Heartland Institute, Cato Institute, et cetera. And organizations like ExxonMobil have done that in the past, though they've stopped fairly recently. So I think a number of us, myself included, are ignorant of the fact that many of them are actually acknowledging on their websites that we have a problem. So here's some of that. ExxonMobil has indicated that wrong page. Let me start with BP. I've got it in chronological order or alphabetical orders, and I've got the seven companies here. BP acknowledges the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, talks about climate change is happening as a result of greenhouse gases, and that can lead to more extreme weathers. And they say, quote, results from models assessed by the IPCC suggest that to stand a reasonable chance of limiting warming to no more than 2 degrees Celsius, global carbon dioxide emissions need to peak before 2020 and be cut by between 50 to 85% by 2050. So BP acknowledges that we certainly don't see any efforts to peak before 2020. Interestingly, BP has taken the approach of internalizing the cost of expected governmental pricing on carbon. They say that for all new projects, they think the governmental policy to limit carbon is likely to go ahead, and so they're now pricing their projects with a $40 per ton added internal value. Chevron was perhaps the most meek in its declaration. They simply say that they, quote, recognize and share the concerns of governments and the public about climate change. There is a widespread view that the increase in atmospheric greenhouse gases is a contributor to climate change with adverse effects on the environment. Now, ConocoPhillips indicates a little more forcefully that burning of fossil fuels is contributing to increased concentrations of greenhouse gases, which is adverse, causing adverse changes to climate change. And their CEO, Ryan Lance, has said the same thing publicly. Now, getting to ExxonMobil, they acknowledge that climate change is happening and that it's caused by fossil fuels in part. And they say, quote, "We believe a well-designed, revenue-neutral carbon tax mechanism provides a more cost-effective alternative to a cap-and-trade regime for reducing greenhouse gas emissions," unquote. And Rex Tillerson has been on record promoting a carbon tax. Now, I want to point out that these recommendations came when they were facing cap-and-trade a few years ago.
Wait a minute. Rex Tillerson is in favor of a carbon tax, the guy who would like us to move farms northward because of climate change?
Exactly. Exactly. But keep in mind that the suggestion of a carbon tax was really a defensive position that the company and Rex Tillerson made when they were faced with cap-and-trade. Instead of cap-and-trade, they prefer a carbon tax. And it's the proof is in the pudding. When cap-and-trade died a few years ago, they were no longer so strongly supporting or trying to rally up the tribe in support of a carbon tax.
All right, now, we'll look at that as a sign of his intelligence, Rex Tillerson, since he's also the one who was famously quoted as having said something like, "We can't save the planet at the expense of humanity."
Exactly. He's basically at this point saying we're just going to have to adapt. There's nothing we can do about it.
Yeah, how do we go from problem what problem to, oh, too late?
Yeah, it's, well, we have some solutions for him, and we're trying to make contact. And if Rex, if you're out there listening, please give me a call or somebody else within Citizens Climate Lobby.
I wish.
So Hess is another company that says it, quote, supports U.S. climate change legislation that treats all affected parties equitably and cost-effectively, unquote. Now, it came out with that at the time of the cap-and-trade as well. Shell says, and this is perhaps one of the strongest statements, quote, "CO2 emissions must be reduced to avoid serious climate change. To manage CO2, governments and industry must work together. Government action is needed, and we support an internal framework that puts a price on CO2. Finally, Total says there's a consensus in the scientific community. It refers to the IPCC. It says international effort is necessary to keep the resultant temperature increase to 2 degrees Celsius by 2100. And then, quote, "The oil and gas industry has a direct stake in the problem and possible solutions to curbing global emissions," unquote. So, Betsy, when you add all these up, you've got seven major oil companies saying, we've got a problem. And those who say we need to do something about it are consistent in listing certain basic parameters, and those tend to be transparency, revenue neutral, broad spread, trying to bring in the international community, things along that line. And the interesting thing is, all of those things that they've described, and I've just given a little touch of them, but in more full detail on their websites, they describe things that match exactly what Citizens Climate Lobby is promoting right now, a revenue-neutral carbon fee and dividend. And the way it works is we would have at least $15 to $10 every year increase in the carbon pollution-producing products as far upstream as possible, meaning at the wellhead, at the mine, at the port of entry. So each year it goes up, let's say, $15. Within 10 years, you're talking about $150 per ton. And each dollar translates to about a penny per gas a gallon of gas. So if all of that money is returned to all households, two-thirds of the households either make money or break even. So it's progressive. And by having the steady increase, you have economists, you have conservative economists like Art Laffer, Greg Mankey, and folks like George Shultz, all saying this can be a huge stimulus to the economy, put renewables on a level playing field with fossil fuels, and be exactly what it takes to put a price on carbon, allow everybody to have skin in the game, motivates everybody to change their behavior in very, very positive ways. So we think that this is exactly the bill that's in order, and we're trying to make contact with oil companies to suggest to them this would be a really smart thing to do now to make an orderly transition so that you don't find yourself really in bad shape. Let's say it's 4 or 5 years from now when the when climate change has gotten so crazy and weather has become so extreme that suddenly there is a huge societal push to really clamp down on use of fossil fuels. And all of those assets that are claimed, all the trillions of gallons and whatnot of oil and gas and whatnot, all of that has a very good chance of being stranded assets, and these companies will be in really bad shape unless they start making this orderly transition to renewables.
Hear, hear. Couldn't agree more with you. Let's see if it takes as long as 4 or 5 years for the full impact of climate change, you know, on our shores to be felt. It seems like it's happening. You turn on, you know, the news, and it's like the Weather Channel all the time. Almost every day, or so it seems, at least every week, you know, we're hearing about record heat and terrible wildfires. And, you know, we're still, I guess we're not even in hurricane season yet.
Yes, and for those people who have lived in a certain area for a while, let's just say Oklahoma with the F5 tornadoes, yes, it does happen every now and then, but this frequently, this extreme. The Hurricane Sandy, I'm sure there have been some really bad storms like that before, but we're getting more and more extreme hurricanes, and they're coming in more frequently, and this is exactly what folks like Dr. Hansen has predicted for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a surprise to people who are listening to the science. It may be something that those who are trying desperately not to feel the concern about climate change, maybe they've got vested interests, or they just can't accept that humans can have such a big impact on such a huge world. But, you know, of course, a lot of people will say, well, the weather is changing regularly. And I like to think of weather to be analogous to mood, and climate is more long-term trends, and it's more analogous to personality. So you can have people with good and bad moods jumping all over the place, but their personality is something that you can see over a period of time.
And then there's the baseball analogy. A player on steroids is more likely to hit home runs.
Exactly, and you can never say which home run was caused directly by the steroid use.
Exactly. Well, I just, while you were speaking, John, got a bulletin that tomorrow Senator Whitehouse and Congressman Waxman are going to hold a conference, news conference, to ask that Keystone XL tar sands pipeline be not approved, rejected by the State Department. And so we should have more focus on that. I'm wondering if when you go to these meetings with representatives or their aides, which I imagine is the case more often than not, do you bring up the controversial Keystone Pipeline, or are you very specific about the scope of your conversations?
We do not bring up Keystone. We're very specific that we're seeking the revenue neutral fee and dividend. Keystone is very controversial. A lot of us have pretty strong feelings about it. But if you take a look at the way Americans generally look at it, it's a fairly complicated thing, and most people tend to be in favor of it. But most people who are knowledgeable about climate are very much against it. Because it's such a divisive thing, and because it doesn't advance our goal of trying to have an overarching energy climate policy that affects the entire country, it would be really poor strategy to venture into that particular tar sand, so to speak.
And while the Citizens Climate Lobby was having their conference, very coincidentally, or maybe there's no coincidence really, President Obama, in the sweltering heat and humidity right across town in Georgetown, gave his first ever speech devoted to the climate crisis. What did you think of it?
Well, the timing was rather remarkable. I'd like to think that there was somebody pulling strings for us. But,
he knew you were in town and said, I want to keep these folks happy. They're getting a little restless.
You never know. It could have happened. But I personally think he's pulling out one of the few arrows he's got left in his quiver without Congress working with a Together for National plan. He's got to do something. Is the top-down EPA regulation of power plants the best way to go? In my opinion, no. It only focuses on a small little sliver of the problem. Sure, those power plants using coal are in a sense, a big part of the problem, but it's a sliver part of our society that has to actually deal with that. And so I hope that that the Republicans, who find regulations of that sort an anathema, will come back with a proposal along this more conservative market-based mechanism that we're promoting, the revenue-neutral carbon fee and dividend.
Well, that actually, that conundrum actually gives me hope because, you know, what do they hate more, government
right.
regulation or, you know, voting for anything that might actually, you know, require that we deal with climate change? And you can't have it both ways, right?
That's right. And when you deal with climate change, you really have to get the entire country on board. And so a focus just on power plants is just too small a piece to pick at. The other thing that I haven't mentioned yet about the carbon fee and dividend is that there's a border adjustment. And this is actually a very critical part to getting international involvement. If there's a country from whom we're importing a product that does not have our equivalent carbon fee, we would charge that fee at the border and keep it for ourselves. That means that, say, India wants to export something to us, they'll very quickly say, wait a minute, we're not going to let the U.S. collect the monies. If we collect it, then the U.S. doesn't charge us anything, we're going to collect it. And so you have a possibility, a very strong possibility of what I call a reverse domino effect, whereby you get our trading partners to jump on board and impose and collect their own carbon fee. And vice versa, we would protect our industries when we are exporting. So if we were to export to India and there were no carbon fee there, then we would reimburse our exporter with the added cost to their product of the carbon fee in the United States. So this international aspect, I think, is a tremendous boon. It will increase our international competitiveness. And it, I think, will achieve what no international convention on climate has been able to achieve for decades, namely a buy-in by other trading partners and ultimately all the major countries of the world.
Hmm. Okay, I can't help but ask you this question, John, since you're such a thoughtful and insightful climate activist and lawyer. You don't usually get those in combination, and super articulate. What do you think about the education piece? President Obama has made some references to the fact that speaking to the American people, he said, you need to talk to each other, talk to, you know, people in your communities, like almost calling on citizens to educate themselves. My particular, you know, focus has been on trying to get more dedicated programming in mainstream media, you know, broadcast outlets, traditional radio and television, at least for starters, as well as, you know, the World Wide Web. Do you think Americans really are fully informed and perhaps informed but not inspired to take action? And do you think some more dedicated media, I don't mean occasional mentions by the newscasters, but, you know, programming that really focuses on the myriad of environmental problems and challenges and crises we have, and all the experts who are on the green front lines, hence the name of my show, who are, you know, very thoughtful and on the cutting edge of what we can do about it?
Great, great, great question, and thank you so much for what you have been doing in your efforts to both bring these sorts of issues to the public as well as to expand its publication, if you will, among broader media. Well, the issue is so big. I could speak to a few neighbors of mine. I can speak to a few colleagues of mine. And if they're not inclined to listen, I've gotten nowhere. If they're already inclined to listen and they're unknowledgeable, how long is it going to take me to discuss things? Basically, they're going to have to rely upon a confidence in me to decide whether or not they're going to trust my opinion that climate change is real and serious and what to do about it. It's just so damn complicated. So what has media done that's made things worse for us? Well, their reference to climate over the last couple years has plummeted to something like 1% of the news issues happens to mention in passing climate. It's some crazy number like that. In other words, it's not being raised. And as we know, most journalists will cover politics coming out of Washington first and foremost. So if politicians, and just think of the presidential election, nobody used the C word, climate. And so the media was not covering the C word, climate. And then on top of that, the lack of discussion of climate, you've got the other problem. When it is occasionally brought up, there is this absolutely absurd sense that you have to have balanced reporting, so that somebody says, yes, there's a problem with climate, and then they balance it with somebody who says, no, there's not a problem with science, I mean with climate. You know, that works if there's a 50-50 split in the scientific community, but that's not the case. We've got 97% of all peer-reviewed climatologists saying, we've got a severe problem. And so why do you balance that with the few who most think are quacks who disagree with that? Makes no sense, but it's done all the time. And that's perpetuating the sense that there truly is a real debate, but there's not.
And the other aspect of the problem, I think you mentioned the C word. What about the Z name? Ever heard of a guy named George Zimmerman? You cannot turn on CNN in the last, 2 weeks without hearing wall-to-wall coverage of the George Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin trial. Not that, doesn't have, important racial issues inherent in it. But my gosh, just imagine if we had that kind of coverage of climate and energy on CNN almost nonstop for several weeks. And now that the trial is over, there's going to be an appeal, and it's not over yet. My husband keeps screaming about it because his last name happens to be Zimmerman, no relation. His grandfather was George Zimmerman, no relation. And he says, I wish they'd stop mentioning this stupid trial. And I get angry for other reasons, because I'm thinking, how important does this really to American people? What kind of real impact is there, short or long term, truly, versus the climate crisis getting worse by the day?
Well, if you tell me that George Zimmerman, who's been on trial, looks a lot like the son of your husband, then I think that's really newsworthy and won't ever stop. No, but seriously.
Well, he's a Jewish Zimmerman, not Hispanic Zimmerman.
So the real problem is having media that does not obsess and fixate for ratings. But we don't have that sort of society. It's very sad. I would have liked to have seen what's going on with the chaos in Egypt, but I'm stuck watching just the same people talking over and over from different angles about the Zimmerman trial. So you're absolutely right. There's a deluge of information on singular things. It could be storm watch. When problems are when the tornadoes are going through Oklahoma, everybody has concern about it. But when that's the only news you can see for the whole day, I don't get that part either.
No,
so I'm not
sure
what the answer is, but it certainly stymies a well-informed citizenry on a host of current issues.
How about a network called ENN for Environmental News Network? Although I think someone already tried that. That's a problem, is environmental media gets so, little capital behind it and support. But, it's time things change, don't you think? I mean, we could literally broadcast 24/7 and not run out of things to talk about. And interesting people like you, John Rees, to interview. So I thank you for your contribution to our show today. Really appreciate your insights.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure, Betsy.
And that does it for the first half of this hour, but we have a great second half coming up for you. In just a couple minutes, we're going to hear about a planned rally. Yes, it's about climate change, but it's for our grandchildren. I'll tell you what grandparents are doing to fight this crisis. And also, we'll tell you about a bus tour taking place in Savannah, also on climate. So I guess the show is devoted to global warming, but different aspects and all interesting, I hope you'll agree. We'll be right back. Stay with us.